theme song to one of the all-time great television sitcoms, which went on the air 50 years ago this month, The Dick Van Dyke Show. To celebrate its 50th anniversary, Vince Waldron has come out with a revised and updated edition of the official Dick Van Dyke Show book, and I've invited him to join me here to talk about it today on the Big 550. Hi, Vince. How are you?
I'm great, Paul. Good to talk to you.
The subtitle of the book is The Definitive History of Television's Most Enduring Comedy. And just for a moment, I want to go back to the word definitive in that subtitle. Here's how you know it's definitive. On the back, there are quotes from the people involved in the book who say that Vince knows more about the show than they do, including the man who created it, Carl Reiner. What did you actually surprise Carl with that he didn't know about his own show?
Well, I was able to fill in all of the details I heard from the costume director. I was able to talk to the person who did the set. I was able to talk to the person who provided the snacks between rehearsals. And I'll tell you, you get a lot of inside information from these folks. I think one of the funniest things was the sponsor of the show was Kent Cigarettes. And so Kent would customarily give all of the actors a carton of Kent Cigarettes as a freebie every week. And the costume director told me, well, you know, none of us smoked Kents. We were Pall Mall people. And he said Mary Tyler Moore particularly was a pack-a-day Pall Mall smoker in those days. And he said that she would customarily go to the local market at the end of every week when they'd get their freebies, and she'd turn them in and trade in her Kents for Pall Mall.
Really?
I think that's the kind of thing they weren't telling Carl.
Now, what's interesting is, as we listen to this and talk about it in 2011, it's been more than 40 years since any cigarette advertising was even allowed on television. But here was a show that was sponsored by a cigarette company. In the days when you did have individual sponsors for primetime shows.
Well, they had Dick and Mary in character touting the virtues of Kent cigarettes. I mean, at the end of the show, you'd get a little bumper commercial where Laura and Rob would come out and be smoking like chimneys and talking about how much they love Kent's, almost as much as each other. I mean, it was and it's something that very much embarrasses Dick when he looks back at it. He goes, oh, I can't believe I was going on a family show touting the virtues of cigarettes. And he actually put a stop to that fairly quickly because he felt it was, you know, not really the thing he wanted to be doing on network television.
Now, let's talk about that phrase right there, family show, because a family show in 2011 can be Modern Family, which is as wild as TV gets in prime time these days. 50 years ago, it was much tamer, of course, to the point where there was a controversy over Mary Tyler Moore's pants.
Well, she wore capri pants, and Mary Tyler Moore, being a young dancer, all of 24 years old, had a very curvaceous figure, and capri pants, being made of a sort of a clingy jersey knit, would cling to her figure and show it off to its best advantage. She wasn't really conscious of this. She was merely wanting to be a comfortable person who was what she saw as a modern housewife who would wear pants. Well, as soon as the sponsors got wind of what she was wearing on set, they said, you know, that's a little racy for us. And they let it be known that they would prefer she would wear a skirt or perhaps something a little more befitting a housewife in 1961. Well, she said, wait a minute, Carl told me I was supposed to be a real housewife, and Carl said to all of us, we've got to play this real. We've got to make this as close to reality as we can, and these are the pants that I wear. And so they made a compromise, finally. She could wear them for one scene per show, and they held her to that until the show went through the ratings roof, and then all bets were off. She wore whatever she wanted, and America survived.
Yeah, America did survive. And success allows you to do pretty much what you want in show business. But it's interesting to me that when they said, you know, this is what real women wear, when they were talking about dresses, what they meant was this is what TV women wear. That was the era where if you were a stay-at-home mom, you stayed at home in a dress, in heels and pearls while you were cleaning the house and cooking the meals as an obedient wife would 50 years ago on TV. But that's not the character that they wanted her to be, right?
No, Carl based all of his characters on his show on people in his own life. The show was very famously autobiographical because Carl himself had been a writer for a variety show in New York and had driven home every night to New Rochelle all throughout the 50s when he was working for Sid Caesar. And it was his idea to capitalize on all of that wealth of great material he had sitting in that room with all those funny people who were the real life counterparts of Buddy and Sally and Mel Cooley and Alan Brady. And he also wanted to emulate the life that he had at home, which was the real revolutionary thing about the show. Not many people in 1950s television really worked. I mean, they went off to jobs, but you never knew what they had done when they came home saying, "Honey, I'm home." You never knew where they came home from.
You know, the thing about this show, you'd say it took off and was a huge success, but not so much that the network wanted to keep it on the air. Is it true that they canceled it after the first season?
Well, it took off only the second season. The first season, it was a dismal ratings failure, and CBS gleefully canceled it because they had seen its ratings failure as vindication, because they had warned the producers early on that a show about a TV writer would never make it, and they advised he change Rob Petrie's profession to insurance salesman. Carl Reiner and his executive producer, Sheldon Leonard, didn't take that advice, and they paid the price when CBS summarily dropped it from their schedule at the end of their first season, and it was only through the begging of Sheldon Leonard, who went back to his sponsors and literally fell on one knee and said, "Hey, go to CBS and tell them you'll sponsor us another year so they'll relent and put us back on the air." And that's essentially what happened. In those days, you could do that. You could go to a sponsor and say, "Hey, we're canceled, but put your clout behind us." And their sponsor at that time happened to be Procter & Gamble, this large company that's made all the toothpaste in the world and all the detergents in the world, and also sponsored all the soap operas on CBS's daytime schedule. So they said, "You know what? If you want to cancel this show that we love, the Dick Van Dyke Show, you probably don't want to anger us because we also sponsor all your very profitable daytime shows." So that was the end of that.
Was the Dick Van Dyke Show better in its second season?
I think it found, like any show, you know, they were still finding their way. I mean, for one thing, poor Carl Reiner had to write two-thirds of the episodes himself because he couldn't find, he was so determined to write a show that was true to his own life that he ended up painting himself in a corner because he couldn't find any other writers who could write in that voice. And when he did, he'd spend another 3 days rewriting their scripts to make sure that it adhered to his own sensibilities and his voice. So it was a very tough year. I think what happened in the second season is they got on track, they knew what they were doing, and so the show was a lot more even. But I don't think it was a particularly better show. It was a great show from the very start. That's one of the things I love about it. It's one of the shows that right out of the gate had a real sense of what it was.
I'm a huge fan of the show myself. I own the box set. I've seen them all. I've showed it to my daughter. She's become a fan of the show. My wife, a longtime fan of it as well. But even as a fan, and I'm sure you would agree with me, there were a few shows that were absolute stinkers. I'm thinking of one in particular where, now you got to remember, in the early 60s, while rock and roll was beginning to take form, and the Beatles, of course, changed everything in February of 1964 with their arrival in America and playing on the Ed Sullivan Show, in 1961, 2, and 3, the first 3 years that the Dick Van Dyke Show was on the air, you had, you know, Elvis America, but you also had Frankie and Annette America, and you had a lot of people in Hollywood who still viewed rock and roll as a fad. And there's one show of the Dick Van, one episode of the Dick Van Dyke Show in which they have a character doing something called the Twizzle, which I guess was their version of Chubby Checker's The Twist, which was, let's admit it, Vince, a terrible episode of any sitcom.
And all of the actors will agree with you. That was one where someone came to Carl, and again, remember, he had to fill 31 slots that season by himself writing. Someone said, "Hey, we got this young guy, I think his name is Jerry Lanning, and he's Roberta Sherwood's son," which means nothing now, but at the time he was the son of a celebrity singer. And they said, the powers that be decided that he would be anointed a pop singer, and the best way to debut him would be on a network show, and Carl Reiner drew the short straw. So he did his best under the circumstances, and looks back without any fondness on that episode.
So
there's a couple that the cast looked back on and cringed, that one, and another one called The Bad Old Days, where Dick and Laura fantasized what it would have been like had they been married in the gay 90s. Fertile premise there.
Where they're horrible costumes.
Yeah, and, you know, handlebar mustaches. It was just, it was also a dreadful premise because the whole thing was precipitated by Buddy challenging Dick to stand up to his wife, Laura, you know, Rob to stand up to his wife, Laura, which, of course, never happened in any other episode. So it was a, you know, again, you've got to remember the guy's writing 31 episodes. He's going to have a couple. But as most of the writers on the show told me when I interviewed them, you know what? Even our worst shows were better than most of anything else that was going on at the time, and probably a lot of shows now.
So the Twizzle episode was a vehicle for this singer whose name was what?
Jerry Lanning.
Oh, Jerry Lanning. Who?
Yeah, right. I think he ended up doing soaps himself, 10 years later. So it didn't, let's just say the sparks didn't fly. It was before the days of vertical integration. Nowadays, I guess they would put him on YouTube and give him his own channel or the reality show about being Jerry Lanning in the Twizzle, my life in the Twizzle.
You know, we were talking before about how the show wasn't really a success in its first season and about how CBS didn't really like the show all that much. Wasn't there a guy who was, I don't know if it was somebody's agent or some executive, who said that this show absolutely will not be a success? There are legendary stories like that. The Beatles had their guy at Decca who said, you know, guitar bands will never take off, and on and on again. You know, the Seinfeld has a famous one, and Ray Romano has a famous story about how, you know, your show will never go anywhere. We've done the research. People don't like this show. Don't ever put it on the air. And then, of course, they were huge hits and ran forever. Was there somebody like that for the Dick Van Dyke Show?
Well, there were a lot of people. In fact, Sheldon Leonard, who was the famous character actor, we remember him as the bartender in It's a Wonderful Life, was approached during the filming of the pilot episode by a very, very, very paternal agent of his who said, you've got to back out of this thing. Get rid of it. Just forget it. Put it behind you. Maury Amsterdam and Rose Marie are old, aging vaudeville actors. Dick Van Dyke has done 5 or 6 pilots that have failed. Carl Reiner just sold this, did a preliminary pilot of this show, and it failed. This show has failure all over it. Get out as quick as you can. And Sheldon Leonard, and one of the reasons why this show was so great is that Sheldon Leonard and Carl Reiner consistently said, "Thank you for your advice. I'm going to go ahead and do the show I want to do," and they did, and it finally did pay off.
Talking with Vince Waldron, who is celebrating the 50th anniversary of the debut of The Dick Van Dyke Show with a revised and updated edition of the official Dick Van Dyke Show book, The Definitive History of Television's Most Enduring Comedy. We started this conversation by playing the opening theme to the show. What many people don't know is that there were actually lyrics to that. You only heard the instrumental version, but a few years ago, Dick Van Dyke formed an a cappella quartet with 3 other guys, and whenever they go out and perform, of course they have to sing this.
So you think that you got trouble? Well, trouble's a bubble. So tell them it's the trouble to get lost. Why not hold your head up high and stop crying, start crying, and don't forget to keep your fingers crossed. When you find the joy of living is loving and giving, you'll be there when the winning dies or tossed. It's just a frown that's turned upside down. So smile on that frown that he caused, and don't forget to keep your fingers off on him.
Yeah! So Vince, what's the story behind those lyrics, and why weren't they in the original show?
Well, Maury Amsterdam wrote those some years later. I think it was even well after the show went off the air. Maury Amsterdam was the kind of fella who just, if he wasn't doing anything else during lunchtime, he would write a song. Something struck him as lacking, that the show didn't have lyrics, and so he sat down and wrote those. And they remained fairly obscure until, as you say, Dick, in one of his many careers as a singer, became formed this barbershop quartet. And he said, "Hey, you know, I just found out Maury wrote lyrics for our song. Let's make that part of our repertoire." And so now it's enjoying a little revival. And Dick's got an album with the Fantastics, which is a CD.
That's the name of the group, the Fantastics?
Yeah, Dick Van Dyke, and I think it's called Put on a Happy Face. But it has an a cappella version of that song on it. It's quite an enjoyable little CD.
Now, speaking of the song and the opening it was attached to, the opening wasn't the Ottoman trip that we saw, that most people think of as soon as they hear that, especially that part with the whoom, boom. That's what you think of him falling on the floor during the theme song. That wasn't there the first year.
No, the first year they started with a very odd little credit sequence where they showed headshots of the actors being strewn on a desk, and it, It's almost like a precursor to Mission Impossible.
That's what I always think of, yeah.
And they had a bongo version of the theme that the composer had forgotten completely that he'd ever recorded when I talked to him. He said, "What? I hate bongos." What? I said, "No, no, the first year, I swear to you, they had a different theme." And he was stunned when I played it for him. Apparently what happened was when they went off the air in the first, there was such a fear that they would fail again in the second season that the sponsor said, "Carl, can you do anything to make the viewers stay tuned from the very first minute? I mean, even the title credit sequence, is there anything you can do to make it suspenseful?" And Carl laughed and said, "Well, there's not a lot you can do with the credits that are the same every week, unless we make two credit sequences, and one in which Dick comes in and says hello to his family and friends, and another in which he says hello to his family and friends and falls over the ottoman. And then we'll put them on in random order every week, and maybe the viewers will stay tuned to find out, oh, let's just watch until we see if he falls over the ottoman or not, and they'll be hooked for the show." It was a little bit far-fetched, but Carl said they were desperate to hold on to that audience, whatever audience they could get.
One of the great reasons that it worked was because Van Dyke was such a brilliant physical comedian, and there were several times on the show where there were bits that Van Dyke would do that were pure slapstick. And I couldn't help but wonder if he had brought some of those to Reiner and said, "Can we put some of these in the show?" Or were there other times where Carl Reiner would write the script and say, "And now Dick does something funny"?
Well, in the beginning, it was more of the former. They had space to fill in their show, and especially even the first episode where they do a little vaudeville act in Alan Brady's apartment. That was all material that they'd had in their repertoire, and Dick had many classic bits which showed up over the years on the show, playing a drunk, trying to sneak home and trick his wife into thinking he isn't drunk, and, you know, things like that, pretending that he's an automobile and being the living, you know, personification of a car. But once the show got rolling, the writers would, Carl Reiner and Persky and Denoff, who were the main writers other than Carl in the third and fourth seasons, fifth seasons, they would go to Dick and say, "Hey, Dick, let's give you a challenge." And they'd say, "Okay, be a guy who just broke his leg and the Novocaine's worn off and he has to play a tennis match." And Dick would do it just for fun in rehearsal. And they'd go, "You know, Dick can do anything." And so whenever they came up with a crazy idea, they'd write a show around it, and they'd leave a space in the show, if it was a physical bit, and say, "Dick does his thing." I mean, they had an episode where Dick went off to a cabin to write his novel, and he ended up being so bored he just started playing with toys and goofing around and basically doing anything other than writing. And so they put Dick alone in a room in a cabin with a bunch of props and silly things and, you know, children's toys and all sorts of whatever they could think of, and they just the episode became, you know, 20 minutes of Dick walking around doing funny things with his props, and they just shot, you know, an hour and a half of it and cut it down to a half an hour, and there was their show.
I can't help but wonder how different that half hour would have been if the Dick Van Dyke Show had been the Johnny Carson Show.
he was briefly suggested when Carl and his producer were deciding who they're going to cast as this, you know, this part, because Carl had originally thought he would play Rob Petrie. Carl, being an actor from the 1950s and a famous second banana for Caesar, when he was going to break through himself, he thought, "Well, I'm going to break through as an actor, of course," because he'd won Emmys for being the supporting player on this variety show in the 50s. And when that didn't work, let's just say the pilot did not sell, rather droves of network and advertising executives stayed away. When they were revamping the show, they said, "Well, who are we going to pick to be this writer who has to be a believable writer and a rather internal person, an introverted person, who also is an extrovert?" And the two names that came up first were Johnny Carson, was briefly considered because he was then a game show host and he hadn't yet hit it as a network talk show host. And they decided, "Oh, wait a minute, there's this other guy doing Bye Bye Birdie. Oh, no, he'd be better." And so they went first to Dick Van Dyke. If Dick Van Dyke had turned them down, they may well have gone to Johnny Carson.
Interesting. I've seen the Carl Reiner pilot, by the way, called Head of the Family.
Mm-hmm.
Not that good.
It's entirely different. I mean, it's done with one camera, which is, you know, it's like a Leave It to Beaver or Father Knows Best episode. It doesn't have the audience. It's as far, really as far away from the show as you can get while still maintaining that same premise.
Yep. What happened to the Walnuts?
You know, the walnuts in the famous episode where Laura Petry falls out of a closet on a bed of walnuts.
My favorite episode of the Dick Van Dyke
walnuts.
Show.
Those were, of course, in the days of... Nowadays would all be CGI, and they'd put them in later with a computer. In those days, they went out to... They scoured the city of Los Angeles for walnut warehouses and found one, and they found a wholesaler who was willing to sell them 3,000 walnuts. But because they were on a very tight budget, Danny Thomas was writing the checks for the show every week, and he had a strict budget of around $40,000 per episode, including actor salaries and scripts and everything else. They could not really afford 3,000 walnuts. So the deal they made was, how about this? We will rent the 3,000 walnuts, and whatever we don't use at the end of the week, we give back to you, and you take them back and credit it back. And they did. And so presumably those walnuts ended up back at the walnut warehouse where they were presumably sold to the Safeways and the and the Krogers of Los Angeles. So in the weeks after that episode aired, I'm sure there were people all over Los Angeles who were eating walnuts that Mary Tyler Moore had ridden in on as a prop on a TV show.
Can you imagine how much money you could make today on any sitcom if you did the same thing? We rented the walnuts, and Sofia Vergara rode in on them on Modern Family, and then we put them back on sale. You wouldn't even have to go to eBay. There would be people all over America who would say, I would love to have those walnuts. And the same, you know, imagine how much money they could have made in 1961. These walnuts have been next to Mary Tyler Moore.
Well, if they did it nowadays, they would put a little product logo on each walnut, so there'd be prominent product placements on screen.
Yes, as ridden by... the TV show is a classic. It's available in box sets and still on TV stations around the country. And the book is the definitive history of one of the great sitcoms of all time. Some would say the greatest sitcom of all time. It's the official Dick Van Dyke Show book, revised and updated now for the 50th anniversary of that show. Vince Waldron, thanks for sharing the memories with me.
Hey, thanks for asking.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.